Well, it's true that the Mormons have that reputation for being out there in the world, worldwide, really doing those things that Christians ought to be doing. I think it's a myth. So does Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. They refuse to be out-compassioned by the Mormon Church. LCMS World Relief underwrites issues, etc. Find out more about them at our homepage, issuesetc.org. There you will find information on all their efforts worldwide. You can also earmark a donation, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. We're talking with Bill McKeever about Mormon Christian dialogue. He's right in the middle of a story. We'll get to that in just a moment. After our conversation with Bill, Colleen Carroll Campbell will join us to talk about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to New York. He wanted to go to Ground Zero. He was refused that, but he did make a number of appearances. And also, she's written an article recently for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on, no matter how old you are, some of us are just still teenagers, perpetual adolescents. A new Pew Forum poll will be the subject of a conversation at 4:30 with Greg Smith of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. The poll has to do with what we know about Mormons and Islam. Pam Fichter will join us for the remainder of that hour, President of Missouri Right to Life, to talk about two abortion-related issues in Missouri. And then Dr. Martin Noland will be our guest in the last hour. We'll talk about Roman Catholicism. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. All right, Bill, you were in the middle of the story about Richard Mao and his misperception, I take it, of some very key doctrines of the Mormon Church. He was under the impression that this notion that God was once a man and that we will one day be gods was no longer a functioning doctrine in the Mormon Church. What did you discover?
Well, when I contacted the PR department of the Mormon Church, I sent an email to Kim Farah, who forwarded my email to Dale Bills, and asking whether or not what Dr. Millett apparently had told Dr. Mao was true. And basically, I found the email right now. This is what he wrote back. He said, "Dr. Millett does not speak for the church. Church doctrine is established by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. Just as Dr. Millett does not speak for the church, I cannot speak for Dr. Millett, nor can I comment on anything he may have said to Dr. Mao." That was the answer. But here was what was telling to me. Dr. Mao berated Christians for not asking Mormons what they believe. So what did I do? I did exactly what Dr. Mao said I should do. I went to the Mormon Church. I went to their PR people, who were the spokesman for the Mormon Church, asked my question, and did I get an answer? No. I did not get an answer to my question. I got another vague response. I wrote back to Dale Bills asking for clarification. He did not write me back. I wrote him back again several months later. He still has not written me back. The fact is, the Lorenzo Snow couplet is very much a functioning teaching in the LDS Church. What is sad is that we have Dr. Mao, who was really out of his league dealing with the subject of Mormonism. That's not his science. That is not his expertise. And to think that BYU professors speak for the church is foundationally flawed. And unfortunately, this is what's happening with a guy like Mao. And no wonder why the Mormons love him. I mean, the Mormons love Dr. Mao. I mean, when Robert Millett got up after Dr. Mao spoke in the tabernacle, his first words were, "I love Richard Mao." Well, of course you do. I mean, he's furthering your cause like nobody else could. And unfortunately, I feel that Standing Together is doing that as well by giving Robert Millett a forum that is virtually unchallenged in a serious way.
All right. What I guess we've talked a lot about the Mormon side of this equation. And since we raised Richard Mao and that incident here, that famous incident now, are Christians involved in this Christian-Mormon dialogue, the new paradigm for dialogue? Are they also downplaying the distinctions between Christianity and Mormonism?
Well, it kind of depends, again, on what group you're looking at. There are a lot of missions teams that come up here to Utah all throughout the year and do engage with students either at BYU or some of the other universities around here. And it kind of depends. If you want to go to BYU, however, you have to go through Greg Johnson's Standing Together. Now, you can be sure that if you go through Standing Together, you're going to get a very, well, how do I word it, very controlled environment. environment to a certain extent. It's not that the students can't ask hard questions one-on-one, but for the most part, you're, again, probably going to hear Dr. Millett give his side of Mormonism. And I do give an example of what happened when a student did go through that regimen and hearing Dr. Millett and walking away thinking, hey, what's the problem here? They sound like they're Christian to me. Well, see, that's really our big complaint. Again, we're not against dialogue. We're not against one-on-one dialogue. In fact, Greg has been told by many men here in the Valley, much better men than I, that nobody is saying not to continue discussions with Dr. Millett, but don't take your discussions public because you don't want to. You either don't have the knowledge or you don't have the will to challenge him on these hard, hard issues that need to be discussed in a public forum. That's the big complaint that we're hearing here.
Now, what, if you could just give us a rundown in the last few minutes that we have together of, other than things like that couplet that is so key to and foundational to the doctrine of Mormonism, mm-hmm. what other kinds of key doctrines of Mormonism are being avoided, sidestepped, or kind of rhetorically dismissed on the Mormon side in these Christian Mormon dialogues?
Well, one of the big issues is the fact that Millett often likes to describe his view of salvation as being unmerited. And in fact, Greg made that a point to me in a private email. And when I asked him about it, I was gathering information for the article. And so I asked Greg some questions. He knew I was writing the article, so it's not like I'm using something that he never asked to be published. But I challenged Greg on this, and I in listening to Millett, he uses these kind of expressions that makes it very much like sound like they believe just like Protestants do when it comes to this issue of salvation. And so he will say things like salvation is not earned or it's unmerited. Well, remember those manuals that I was just telling you a little bit about, the teachings of the presidents of the church? Well, they had one also on the teachings of Harold B. Lee, who was a past president. And this was just not too long ago, just within the past couple of years, there was a phrase in this manual. It says there is only one objective so far as our Father's work is concerned, and that is that in the end, when we shall have finished our work here on earth, whether after a short space of time or a long, we too shall have overcome the world and have earned the right to that place called the celestial kingdom. Now, Millett publicly says he wouldn't probably agree with that statement. But yet, when people see a BYU professor, do most people know that BYU professors don't speak for the church? Not likely. Even though Millett might say, I'm not an official spokesman, because nobody really is in the Mormon church, an official spokesman for the church. But most people seeing this and not knowing how Mormonism works would see a BYU professor from a church-owned school getting a salary from the church speaking on doctrinal issues. Wouldn't it make sense that probably most people, after hearing Millett say that salvation is unmerited, would walk away thinking Mormonism teaches salvation is unmerited? But that's not the case.
How far would somebody like Millett have to go in his Christian-sounding language, ostensibly describing Mormonism, before someone from the apostleship or the first presidency says, Dr. Millett, you need to make up your mind whether you're a Christian or a Mormon?
Well, from what I understand, he has been challenged by some colleagues on this issue of sounding too much like a Protestant. In fact, there was actually a conference message given by Bruce Hafen, who was a 70 in the Mormon church, where he got up in a conference message and was going to spell it out for people that they do not believe like Protestants at all. And when I heard that, I thought that perhaps Hafen was kind of talking about some of the things Millett had said. But you raise a good question. If it's really that different, why does the Mormon church allow Millett to continue doing these things? And I think we have to be just blunt about it and say it's pragmatism. Millett paints a picture of the Mormon church that tends to make most Christians want to back off in their criticism of the Mormon church. Millett isn't mentioning any leaders' names when he makes these comments. He's not really going after any leaders, so that kind of makes him safe, so he doesn't push the envelope too far. Though it might make some leaders a little bit uncomfortable, and I happen to know that this is the case, that there are some leaders that aren't really too happy about this, the fact is he is still allowed to do it. And you have to ask the question, why would the Mormon Church want this to continue unless they saw it as something positive in their favor? I have asked Greg this. Greg, you know as well as I do, the Mormon Church doesn't do anything unless they hope to get something out of it. What do you think they're getting out of these public dialogues? They certainly don't want to support my dialogues, you know, when I speak at churches. They certainly don't want to support Sandra Tanner's, you know, discussion at churches when she talks about Mormonism. Why is Standing Together picked out of the crowd and favored among all the rest? Personally, it's because I think they see Standing Together is not a threat to their agenda.
Folks, you can check out the website for Mormonism Research Ministry. Bill McKeever is its founder. Just go to our website first, issuesetc.org. Click links, and there you'll find a direct link to Bill McKeever and Mormonism Research Ministry. Bill is founder of Mormonism Research Ministry, based in Draper, Utah, author of an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal, an article that I've been waiting for since that whole Ravi Zacharias incident there in Salt Lake City in 2004. It's called The Bridge or the Beehive, Mormon Apologetics in a Postmodern Age. Bill, thanks for being our guest. Thanks for writing that article,
pleasure,
too.
Todd. Thank you.
Well, for the remainder of this segment, Colleen Carroll Campbell is going to join us. We've got two issues on the table with her, working off some things that she's recently written for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. One of them has to do with the Iranian president visiting our country, in particular New York. And the other has to do with what she's calling perpetual adolescence. Colleen Carroll Campbell is a regular guest, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, author of the book The New Faithful, Why Young Adults Are Embracing Christian Orthodoxy, and a weekly columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Colleen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Let's talk about the visit of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in New York. What did he want to do when he came to New York?
Well, what a lot of Americans don't know, but I did mention in my column, and there was a longer story in the New York Times on this topic, he's facing a lot of trouble at home. A lot of Iranians are not happy with the decisions he's made in his government. He's had a lot of political fallout, some top folks in his government resigning. His fiscal policies have not done well for Iran. There are labor strikes, there's popular unrest, and there's been a very severe crackdown on social behavior and dress that he had indicated when he was campaigning he would not focus too much on those issues. For instance, women not being allowed to go to soccer stadiums or being thrown in jail for smoking, that sort of thing. So all of this has kind of contributed to really a loss of popularity in Iran for Ahmadinejad. So Colombia's decision to give him a platform in many ways was playing into his hands by allowing him to distract his own citizens with all of his anti-American rhetoric and giving him really a platform that shows that Westerners are looking to him and that he's respected on the world stage, all of which then boosts his standing back at home.
So this had more to do with the Iranian president's domestic standing, in your mind, than it did with his international standing.
I think he's very concerned with his international standing, and certainly he wanted to get his message out. I think all of that was a factor, but I think somewhat overlooked in the controversy, yes, was this idea that, he's not necessarily on totally solid ground at home. So whenever we elevate him and give him a platform, we're really helping him stay in power.
He had asked to visit Ground Zero. He was not permitted to do that, of course. I guess we can only speculate as to what would have been the effect of him standing there at Ground Zero with the cameras on.
Well, I think it would have been deeply disturbing and damaging. I went to Ground Zero yesterday. I was in New York as I was writing this week's column, and I went there on the and it was, you know, a really moving and difficult experience, even as someone who didn't have a loved one who died there in the rubble of the World Trade Center. It was really something to see the memorial still to the firefighters lost, the policemen, and then thousands of just normal working Americans who got up that morning and went to their jobs and didn't deserve this. And I think it's just, I think it's really appalling that he would try to go there And then also what got overlooked in some of the coverage of his request to go there was not simply that he wanted to lay a wreath at Ground Zero, but he had also said in the past that he wanted to talk at Ground Zero about the root causes of terrorism. Now, when you're talking about a man like Ahmadinejad, when he says root causes of terrorism, you can guess who he's talking about, and that is really blaming the victim and blaming Americans, blaming Israel, blaming those who are targets of a lot of this Islamo-fascist terrorism.
Many watched the speech that he made at Columbia University. Many watched the speech that he made later at the UN. And I don't know, maybe an impulse reaction was, look, this is just another fly-by-night dictator, another tin horn type of a guy out there. Is that your assessment of Ahmadinejad?
It isn't. And the reason is that I think Iran is really, the foremost opponent right now of the United States, posing the greatest danger. This has been said by folks on both sides of the political aisle. Ahmadinejad is really funding and arming the terrorists who are fighting and killing our American soldiers right now in Iraq. He's really waging a proxy war, and this is something, again, that has been affirmed by leaders in both political parties, by intelligence officers. So this is not a rumor. I mean, this is really someone who is driving and fueling a lot of what's happening in Iraq, a lot of the deadly violence that's killing our men and women in the armed forces. And regardless of how one feels about the war, whether or not we should have been there, we're there now. Americans are dying now, and they're dying at the hands of people who are getting a lot of their weapons and support from this man. So to give him a platform at one of our prestigious universities in the name of free speech, only to allow him to continue to proclaim his anti-Semitic rantings and lies from a podium to an audience of college students, I think it's ridiculous. I don't think there need to be laws against this sort of thing. Yes, there is a right for a university to bring in speakers they choose, but I think it was deeply irresponsible. And in the city where 9/11 hit hardest, I think it was really insensitive.
Many have said, well, look, John Coatsworth, who defended the Columbia University speech of the Iranian president under the guise of free speech, with which you have no argument, he offset the offense given here because his introduction to Ahmadinejad was pretty hard-nosed, not a friendly introduction to this man by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right, and Columbia President Lee Bollinger as well, very, very scolding introduction, calling him you are one who shows all the signs of being a cruel and petty dictator, and he kind of runs through this laundry list of his failings. I, however, just did not get a lot out of this. I thought it was too little, too late, and I thought it was a little bit silly to invite this man, give him a podium, and then sort of act as his cartoonish foil. We are the forces of right and good, and you here are despicable. If he's truly despicable, which he is, I think, and certainly his anti-Semitic ideas and his very troubling condemnations of Americans and Jews, he shouldn't be given a platform. And when you give someone a platform and then you try to scold them to make up for it, I think you just wind up looking silly. I was not at all heartened by Bollinger's act. I thought it was really actually, I thought it was just a PR stunt, frankly.
What did Ahmadinejad say about the Holocaust? In the past, he's openly denied that it even took place. Did he go that far in his speech at Columbia University?
He tried to backtrack off that a little, and he has called it a myth. He hosted a conference of Holocaust deniers, I believe it was last year, and he said that Israel should be wiped off the map. So, I mean, his track record on this is pretty clear. When pressed on it, I think he tried to say that, well, what I'm interested in is looking at it from different perspectives. I believe he compared it to physics, said, you know, we don't just stop studying physics. We shouldn't just stop studying the Holocaust, which, you know, if you really look at what he means by looking at the Holocaust from other perspectives, he even mentioned, in fact, at Columbia that he wanted to look more at the root causes of the Holocaust. That is, looking past the Nazis, I believe, at Jews themselves and trying to pin the Holocaust on the victims, which I think is just appalling. But he also was pressed to say whether or not he recognized any right for Israel to be there. I think he was asked specifically about that statement, whether Israel should just be wiped off the map, and he really wouldn't say whether or not he supported the wholesale killing of Jews. He really wouldn't come down very clearly on that question. So, you know, I mean, I think that leaves enough open to get a sense of where this guy is coming from.
You've also recently written about perpetual adolescence, the Peter Pan society, and what it's like to grow old in a society of wrinkly teenagers, I guess, or wrinkly adolescents. Give us your thoughts on that with only about 2.5 minutes here.
Well, I was provoked by a new book called The Death of the Grown-Up by a columnist named Diana West, and she contends that American adults are really trapped in a state of arrested development, that we're all so focused on trying to stay young and hip and cool that we're not growing up and confronting the very grown-up dangers America faces right now. And I took that and kind of looked at the elderly in the same way, and the pressure that more and more elderly feel today to be hip and attractive and constantly focused on some of these same values they had to focus on in high school. And I think a lot of that is a result of a pop culture that really holds up adolescence as the pinnacle of life, when really later in life we develop some of the wisdom that is much deeper and more meaningful than what we know when we're teenagers.
You know, it occurred to me a couple of years ago, Colleen, that it is a very sad prospect indeed to think that in society or government there aren't any grown-ups who can show up, kind of put their foot down and say, all right, enough of this fooling around, you kids. And that's a pretty sad prospect.
It certainly is. And I think it's a little sad when a culture is so focused on who's hip and new and novel and cool and with it that we can't even proclaim if some things are right and some things are wrong. I think that contributed to this very incident in Colombia that we saw, where we can't even decide if Adolf Hitler would deserve a speaking invitation or not. I think we need to be grown up and say some things really are just wrong.
With only 30 seconds, do you think the baby boom generation will ever look in the mirror and say, okay, we're old, we admit it, and now it's time to wise up?
Well, I think certainly some baby boomers have reached that point of maturity. There is this obsession with remaining young because it was so much a part of the baby boomer identity, and baby boomers are very intent on remaking old age. In some ways, that can be good in terms of staying active and independent. But if it continues to be a focus on looks and sex appeal as opposed to substance and spirituality, I think that's going to be a loss for the baby boomers and all of America.
Colleen Carroll Campbell is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, author of the book, The New Faithful, Why Young Adults Are Embracing Christian Orthodoxy, and a weekly columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You can read her columns on the web at ColleenCampbell.com. It's Colleen-Campbell.com. Colleen, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Issues Etc. is brought to you in part by Concordia University St. Louis Center. Find out more about what they're doing to help you extend your education, be it through an associate's degree, bachelor's degree, master of business administration degree. 314-984-8840. 314-984-8840, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on Concordia University St. Louis Center. When we come back, we're going to be halfway through the program, and we'll be talking with Greg Smith. Very interesting poll that the Pew Center for Religion and Public Life has come out with, asking Americans what they know, what they think they know, about both Mormonism, something we talked about earlier here on the program, and Islam, the two big unknown religions in the West. We'll find out after this as we talk with Greg Smith, a fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, based in Washington. After that conversation, Pam Fichter will be our guest. Two related issues on abortion in Missouri. We'll need to talk with her about that. She's from Missouri Right to Life. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you want more of God's grace? Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares, with a vibrant historic Christian liturgy. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg.
On our Bible study earlier today, Pastor Tom Handrick suggested that in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he was addressing conflict between the members of the congregation. In 2 Corinthians, he said he might be talking about conflict between pastor and people. If you'd like to hear that conversation, tune in tonight. We repeat the Bible study in the evenings at 6:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Parental rights took a hit in Pennsylvania last week. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a state-run health clinic has no obligation to inform the parents of a minor that their child was given the morning after pill. Steve Jordahl reports when it comes to sexuality, parental guidance is routinely cut out of a child's life.
16-year-old Melissa Anspach feared she was pregnant after she had sex, so she went to Philadelphia's Department of Public Health for the morning after pill. Randy Wenger of the Pennsylvania Family Institute says Anspach reacted adversely to the pills.
The only reason that the parents found out about it is because the 16-year-old girl was vomiting so much that her eye hemorrhaged. Her eye was beginning to bleed.
Anspach and her parents sued the city, claiming their parental and First Amendment rights were violated. The court ruled that the clinic doesn't have to, quote, ensure that children abide by their parents' wishes, values, or moral beliefs. Clark Forsyth of Americans United for Life says it's a blow to parental rights.
The traditional rule was that no doctor, no medical professional could touch a child without parental consent, not just notice, unless a life-threatening medical emergency was at stake.
Bruce Hauskenek, the Focus on the Family Action, says courts seem to have a special disdain for parents when it comes to sexual politics.
Since we have elevated abortion in this country to such a high place, we have to sacrifice parental rights on the altar of abortion rights.
Unfortunately, it's that sensitive topic where parental advice is often needed most. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
No word as to whether there will be an appeal to the Supreme Court where precedent supports this decision. Hauskenek says even with the current makeup of the court, pro-lifers are still one vote shy of overturning trends favoring abortion. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here's a very special AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Thursday, September 27th, 2007, Melford and Dorothy Wilkie. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of their 60th wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to our AM 850 KFUO day sponsors, Melford and Dorothy Wilkie of St. Louis, and best wishes for a very happy 60th anniversary.
Is there a relationship between creation and salvation? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is God Made It For You. It's a children's book on the creation story. For more information, find the cover of God Made It For You on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God Made It For You is written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Charles Lehman. God Made It For You.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here, halfway through the program, we're going to be listening to an interview we did earlier today with Greg Smith, a fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life based in Washington, D.C. You may have seen this poll that came out from the Pew Forum. It's what Americans know about Mormonism and what Americans know about Islam. Apparently, Americans don't feel like they know enough or a lot, and yet they're still forming opinions about both Mormonism and Islam. Some interesting findings ahead in this interview. After we conclude our interview with Greg Smith, we'll talk with Pam Fichter about two abortion-related issues in Missouri. She's from Missouri Right to Life. Greg Smith is a fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life based in Washington, D.C. Our interview earlier today started with the question, what surprised him most about this new poll on what Americans know about Mormonism and Islam?
Well, I think one of the most surprising findings is that despite the attention to Islam and to Mormonism in the media and in other sources over the last several years, lots of people still say that they don't actually know very much about either of those religions. In fact, only about 4 in 10 people say that they know at least a little bit or at least something about Islam. that's really not up very much, even since 2001 or 2002. A few more people say they know something about Mormonism, but even there, a majority say that they don't know very much or know nothing at all.
What about favorable versus unfavorable? I guess with the lack of knowledge there, kind of have to take that with a grain of salt. But how does Mormonism come out in those terms?
Well, even though a lot of people say that they don't know a whole lot about these religions, most people are able to express an opinion with respect to their overall views of each of the religions. Mormons, when we ask people if they generally have a favorable or unfavorable view of Mormons, opinion overall is favorable. Slightly more than half of the public says that they have a favorable view of Mormons. That, however, is a lower favorability rating than we see for several other groups. About three-quarters of the public, for instance, says that they have a favorable view of Jews. The same number says they have a favorable view of Catholics, and 6 in 10 say that they have a favorable view of evangelical Christians. So Mormons, though viewed favorably overall, are viewed a little bit less favorably than some of these other groups.
And Islam, in terms of favorable and unfavorable?
Islam is very interesting. When we ask people about their views of Muslim Americans, exactly the same numbers say they have a favorable view of Muslim Americans as say the same thing about Mormons, 53%. When we ask people about their view of Muslims, however, somewhat fewer, 10 points fewer, 43% say that they have a favorable view of Muslims. So Muslim Americans are viewed somewhat more favorably than are Muslims asked about generally.
Is Islam connected in the minds of the American people, according to this poll, with violence?
Well, it is, at least for a lot of people. We've been asking the question over the years whether or not people think that Islam encourages violence more so than other religions. And we've seen that fluctuate up and down since 2002. But our most recent poll finds that the number saying that Islam is more likely than other religions to encourage violence has increased over the past year, up about 9 points to 45%. In fact, a plurality, 45%, as I said, now do take the view that Islam more than other religions encourages violence.
What did you discover about the influences on people's views of Muslims?
Well, there's a few interesting things to point out there. We did ask people what has been the biggest influence on their views of Muslims. And the single most commonly cited influence is the media. About 1 in 3 say that the media has been the biggest influence on their view of Muslims. That's followed by personal experience and education. About 1 in 5 say that each of those has been the greatest influence in their view of Muslims. One of the interesting things that the survey finds is that the media is a particularly important source of influence for people who have an unfavorable view of Muslims. Among those who have an unfavorable view, almost half, 48%, say that the media is the biggest influence on their view of Muslims. That's more than twice as high as the number who cite the media among those who have a favorable view of Muslims. Among people who view Muslims favorably, personal experience and education are each cited more often than is the media as an important source of influence.
So what does that tell you? What kind of a conclusion could you draw from that bit of information?
Well, one of the conclusions or one of the key findings of the poll is that knowing someone who happens to be Muslim is highly correlated with more favorable views of Muslims themselves and of Islam. For instance, people who say that they personally know a Muslim are much more likely than others to say that Islam does not encourage violence. At the same time, people who know a Muslim are much more likely than others to say that Islam and their own religion has a lot in common. So familiarity with Islam, knowing a Muslim, really seems to be a key correlate of views of Islam and of Muslims.
Did you discover the same correlation when it came to the views of Mormons, whether or not someone knew a Mormon? It depended on what their view was?
Yes, well, there is a similar link there. People who say that they personally know a Mormon do tend to express somewhat more favorable views of Mormonism and of Mormons than do those who don't know a Mormon. But the link is not nearly as strong as that seen with respect to views of Muslims and of Islam. When it comes to Mormonism, what we found is that even more closely linked to views of Mormonism is one's view of whether or not Mormonism is a Christian religion. Only about half the public says that Mormonism is a Christian religion, and about a third say that Mormonism is not a Christian religion. Among people who say that Mormonism is a Christian religion, favorable views of Mormons and of Mormonism are much higher than they are among people who say Mormonism is not a Christian religion.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilk, and Greg Smith is our guest. He's a fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life based in Washington. We're talking about a new poll from the Pew Forum on what Americans know about Mormonism and Islam. One of the more intriguing aspects of this poll was eliciting from people a one-word impression or one-word description of Mormonism and Islam. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, it's always interesting to ask people what immediately pops into their mind when they think of a particular concept, or oftentimes we'll ask what people think of a particular person. And on this survey, we asked people to just tell us the one word that best describes Islam on the one hand and Mormonism on the other hand. And what we found with respect to Islam was that, on balance, people tended to give a negative response rather than a positive response. 30% named a negative word, a negative description, compared to 15% who gave a positive description. With that said, though, the one word or the one derivative of a word that was most commonly used to describe Islam, it was a positive word, devout and devoted, and devotion and other synonyms was the single most commonly used word. But as the overall balance of negative to positive opinions suggests, negative words were also quite common as well. Nearly as many as said devout said fanatic or fanatical to describe Islam, and other words that were commonly mentioned included radical, as well as terror and terrorism, and violence and violent. When we look at Mormonism, overall the balance of positive to negative responses is a little bit more positive. But it is interesting to note that even though the Mormon Church banned polygamy over a century ago, the polygamy and bigamy and some other references to multiple marriages is the number one response that we get when asked about a one-word description of Mormonism. On the flip side, though, almost as many people who cite multiple marriages say that family or family values or something of that nature is what comes to mind when they think of the Mormon religion.
What do Americans appear to know about their own religions as they contrast them with these religions, Mormonism and Islam?
Well, we didn't ask too much by way of knowledge questions in terms of what people know about the doctrines of their own particular religious group. But one of the things that we did ask was we asked people whether or not they think their own religion has a lot in common with Islam on the one hand and with Mormonism on the other. And what we find is that most people say that their own religion is quite different than both Islam and Mormonism. In fact, 7 in 10 say that their own religion is very different than Islam, and that's actually up 11 points over a couple of years ago. And almost as many, more than 6 in 10, say that Mormonism is very different than their own religion, compared to only 1 in 4 who say that they have a lot in common with the Mormon religion.
Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is a Mormon, and he's also running for president on the Republican ticket. What did you discover in your poll that might have some bearing upon a first Mormon president or a first Mormon running for president?
Well, it's very interesting. On the one hand, our poll finds that religion is really a positive for candidates. That is to say that candidates who are viewed as being religious themselves are also viewed more favorably by the public. It also turns out that Mitt Romney, more than any of the other candidates, is seen by the public as being very religious. Most of the candidates are seen as being at least somewhat religious, but Romney alone is really seen as being very religious. And that does help him. He is seen more favorably by those who view him as religious than he is by those who view him as not religious. There aren't many people who don't view him as religious, but nevertheless, that's a net positive for Romney. On the other hand, though, the same poll also finds that a large number among the public say that they would be less likely to vote for a Mormon candidate for president. In fact, about a quarter of the public says they'd be less likely to support a presidential candidate who is Mormon.
Finally, then, you mentioned early in our conversation a more favorable impression on the part of those who took the poll of American Muslims than of Muslims in general. What do you think is in that difference?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but I do think that the second part of the question there, the word Americans, does have something to do with it, people tend to have a more favorable view of Americans than they would of people of other nationalities, and I think that you see part of that at play there in the results to those questions. That's not an unusual finding, by the way. We do consistently find over the years that Muslim Americans are consistently rated more positively than are Muslims considered generally.
Greg Smith is a fellow for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life based in Washington. They have a new poll, What Americans Know About Mormonism and Islam. You can read it for yourself at pewforum.org, pewforum.org. Greg, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
In the last few minutes of this hour, we're going to be talking with Pam Fichter, president of Missouri Right to Life. You might have seen these two stories recently in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. One was in Saturday's story from the Associated Press, hearing set Monday on abortion policy for Missouri inmates, a short story on a very significant subject. And the other that we'll discuss with her is Order Stalls of Missouri abortion law that changes clinic requirements. Another big story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch having to do with Missouri and the issue of abortion and abortion clinics. Pam, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Nice to be back.
Well, we read on Saturday about a planned 3-judge panel of the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals hearing arguments in a case where female inmates wanted to get state transportation to have an abortion. What was decided in that case?
Well, what they're deciding, it's still being argued on that. What the question is whether or not to uphold the Missouri law that says that the state is not obligated to provide transportation to women seeking an abortion who are incarcerated.
What's the argument being made against that ban, if you will?
Well, the ACLU is arguing that a woman has an absolute right to abortion and that she has a right to be able to obtain that. And we know from the 1989 Supreme Court Webster decision that upheld the state's right to not fund, to subsidize abortions in any way. And certainly if the state is going to pay for transporting a woman to get an abortion, that would equate with subsidizing the abortion.
What do you expect will be the outcome of this 3-judge panel of the 8th Circuit Court?
Well, I really have no way of knowing what the final decision is going to be, but we certainly hope that the court is going to acknowledge the impact of the Webster decision, the Supreme Court decision, and not use taxpayer money to subsidize abortions.
Could this, if it is seen in light of Webster, could this, if decided one way or the other, end up back at the Supreme Court as an application of Webster?
Well, I'm not the legal mind on it. I certainly can't predict how things are going to go through the courts. I mean, we've been surprised, you know, many times by actions that the court have taken, both in our favor and against what we'd like to see. So we'll just have to see how it plays out in the courts. But we certainly think that there is a very strong case to be made for not using taxpayer money to provide transportation for women to obtain an abortion.
So with only about a minute here, what is that case? How would you argue at a layperson's level that the state should not even pay for a female inmate to be transported to receive an abortion?
Well, if a woman is incarcerated, then she is basically at taxpayer expenses any transportation that she has. And I don't have the figure in front of me, but I believe it's over $300 what it costs the state to transport a woman for an abortion, and that certainly would equate to having taxpayer funding to subsidize an abortion.
The other story that we wanted your thoughts on has to do with, and we've talked with you about this before, a Missouri law that would impose what the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is calling added restrictions on abortion clinics. What's the story here?
Well, the story here is not so much that they, you know, they're added restrictions. I think that the question is, why haven't abortion clinics been held to the same standard of medical care that has been required of ambulatory surgical centers? Because that's what this law said. It said that abortion clinics had to adhere to the same standards of ambulatory surgical centers. And the abortion people in Missouri, the abortion industry, is disputing this, saying that, you know, that they're not going to, that it's going to be very costly to comply. And I think the question that we have to ask is why haven't they been complying? Why does it take a law to require them to provide the same standard of medical care?
What's your answer to that question? Why haven't abortion clinics been willing to voluntarily view themselves as ambulatory surgical centers and comply with the regulations that are attached?
Well, you know, this is a for-profit business, and, you know, I can't, you know, say specifically why they haven't. But, you know, if you look now at what they're saying, that it's going to be very costly for them to comply with these, then, you know, it could be that it's a financial issue with them. But we certainly think that women have the right to the same standard of medical care. You know, with the judge's decision on this, we really have kind of mixed emotions, because on the one hand, he didn't acknowledge the dangers of chemical abortions in his ruling. And the FDA has acknowledged that chemical abortions are dangerous. And they have, the FDA requires that medical facilities that dispense them must be equipped to provide emergency care. Clinical trials where women have been given these chemical abortifacients, 1 out of 12 women required surgical intervention after taking it. So we're very disappointed that the judge is seemingly not acknowledging the dangers of chemical abortions. But on the same, you know, then on the other hand, he did acknowledge that it was reasonable for the legislature to say that the safety of women that have surgical abortions could be promoted by applying Missouri's ambulatory surgical center regulations to them. So, you know, now he's given the parties time to negotiate variances, and we know that the Department of Health has hired special legal counsel in this, and we're just very hopeful that the Department of Health will continue to, you know, maintain a firm position in favor of women's health and to oversee the standards in these clinics.
Are you concerned about the continued involvement of Attorney General Jay Nixon, given the fact that he's openly supported abortion rights?
Well, we are concerned. We don't know, you know, we don't, you know, when he's as strong a supporter of abortion rights as he is, you have to wonder how enthusiastically he's going to enforce laws like this, and that's why the Department of Health in Missouri has brought in outside legal counsel to argue this case.
How do you respond to some who have said, in particular, this is Bonnie Scott Jones, who's the New York-based Center for Reproductive Rights senior attorney. She calls the Missouri law in question the most onerous of its kind in the country.
Well, then it must be hitting them where it hurts. You know, again, it's a common sense protection of women's health. Why do they so strenuously object to it, and why have they not been adhering to these types of standards in the past? You know, I think that they're going on offense here simply because I think it makes them look very bad. You know, that they have to, you know, that spend a lot of money to comply with very basic standards of medical treatment. I think it doesn't say very much about the standards that are now present in the abortion industry.
Do you think the average woman in Missouri knows that an abortion clinic in Missouri, at least since this law is still in limbo, does not have to comply with the regulations that are expected from the state of any ambulatory surgical center she may go to?
No, I don't think the average person knows these things at all. I mean, so we take so much for granted. You know, we assume that if a business is open and licensed in a state, that there's some degree of oversight to that would set safety standards. for the consumer. And I think that many people were very surprised to learn that abortion clinics had not been compelled to adhere to these types of standards.
Would this law, if finally enacted and enforced, in any way impinge upon the abortion clinic's ability to do what they do, to put it lightly?
No, I mean, this is, you know, certainly we're not going to be brokenhearted if an abortion clinic closes. You know, we make no secret about that. But that's not the intent of the law. The intent of the law was to provide some basic standards of safety for women who seek an abortion. And if a clinic is not able to comply with that and has to close their doors, then, you know, then I think that the women are better off for it. But that wasn't the intent of the law. And but if that happens again, we certainly would not be brokenhearted by that.
Pam Fichter is president of Missouri Right to Life. MissouriLife.org is the website address for Missouri Right to Life. Pam, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
That website.
Always a pleasure.
The website address again, MissouriLife.org. Folks, Concordia Seminary St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary Fort Wayne are preparing pastors, among other things, to defend life from beginning to end. To find out about these two seminaries, check out our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, Concordia Theological Seminary Fort Wayne, and Concordia Seminary St. Louis. Do me a favor this weekend. Go to our website. I know that you visit it often, issuesetc.org, and print out a flyer with information on how your congregation can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. You may have never thought about this, including Issues Etc. in its mission or advertising budget for the next year. Our website address, issuesetc.org. Look for the logo of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod right there at our homepage. Click it, and you'll find this information. It's ready to print for you and for your congregation. Issuesetc.org. Ask your pastors, elders, evangelism committee members to include Issues Etc. in their budget for next year. Issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, Dr. Martin Noland will be our guest. We're going to be talking about Roman Catholicism. Is it what it was? We can look at the Council of Trent and see Roman Catholicism immediately after the Lutheran Reformation. There's a stark contrast there between the Reformation and Roman Catholicism. That was 500 years ago. Is Roman Catholicism still what it was in the Middle Ages and at the time of the Reformation, or has it changed? We'll be answering that question with Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute on the other side of this break. Sunday night on the program, great topic and a great guest. Youth ministry. Everybody is concerned. Everyone is concerned about youth ministry. Pastor George Borghardt will join us Sunday night. That's from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis, or 9 to 11 on the web at kfuo.org. I know I just got three letters from my pastor. Three letters in one day from my pastor on the youth ministry, the youth group at our church. The first one started with, well, you attended the meeting. Now we're telling you when the next meeting is. It's time to get something going. There's a sense of urgency about this, and that's good. But what should youth ministry be? Should it be something different than the general ministry of the church to sinners at large, regardless of their age? We'll talk about it with George Borghardt Sunday night on the program. When we come back, Roman Catholicism, what do you do with it? How do you understand it? Is the Roman Catholic Church a church of Christians? Is it Christian? Are its teachings all Christian? What about its claim to be the one, the only church that there really is? And the rest of us? Well, we're ecclesial communities. We may be churches in a small C sense. How do you deal with that? How do you answer it? How far has Roman Catholicism here in the 21st century deviated from the teachings of Scripture? Dr. Martin Noland will be our guest right after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.